Thoughts for Haiti, that has been suffering terribly since January 12th, continues to suffer through its cholera epidemic, and now it's a hurricane that's destroyed crops.
Left butt.
Right there. Destroyed crops and houses. So we are rolling a very large boulder up a very steep hill. I'd also like to start by acknowledging the real parents of community-based primary care in Haiti, who eradicated just about neonatal tetanus by their actions at Hospital Albert Schweitzer, and that are Drs. Warren and Gretchen Berggren. And most of what I do is because of them. So today's talk is about a traditional birth attendance and what we've been able to accomplish. I want to thank my co-workers, Professor Judy Lewis from the University of Connecticut Medical School, Betty Joseph Pierre, Callie Kaplan, other medical and public health students, as well as Dr. Frank Anderson from the University of Michigan, and all of the midwives and village health workers who continue to try to save babies and moms. I'm going to speak very briefly in this way about the context of what we're doing and what we have yet to do with TBAs. Of course, you've seen this on CNN. You know, Haiti's been in the press. We work at the very tip of the island where the Hurricane Tomas sort of made a little blip to the side, saving really millions of people from certain death. 90% of babies in the rural areas deliver at home, and from what I learned in Port-au-Prince, even though there are hospitals, women still prefer to deliver at home. Traditional birth attendants are extremely important in this country. It says 15% of pregnancies with life-threatening complications, but we really know that everybody is at risk. And so with that, pregnancy in Haiti certainly is not a fun event. It's really scary. There are very few hospitals in Haiti, and many were destroyed during the earthquake, and an obvious shortage of trained health professionals. We work in the Grand Anse, which is labeled over there. It's a 12-hour trip by boat or by truck. And I'll get to that later. I can, get ahead of myself. The Haitian Health Foundation, there's a couple things I want to mention about it. We balance relief with development. You can't do development when people are starving or during an epidemic or whatever. That we are family registered, that all of the families in 104 villages were censused in 1987, recensused all the time, and a complete validation is done every 5 years. So we know exactly how many women there are, children, pregnant women, adolescents, you name it. And as we just talked about with Dr. Labak, we can now follow the girls who were born into our program in the 1980s and 90s and look at their pregnancy and breastfeeding outcomes. But anyway, that's another story. So I went there, for a year in 1987 to do my doctoral work in medical anthropology, and there you have it, I'm still there. We did everything we were supposed to do. We've been funded by USAID since 1987. We did, prenatal visits. There were three at that time, tetanus toxoid, ferfolate, education on prenatal danger signs, and the maternal mortality rate kept going up. So it's obviously from home to hospital, it's on the continuum of all that we have to do to save mothers and newborns, and built Haiti's first maternal waiting foyer close to the hospital, Saint Antoine, in 2002. Most of the places where we work are not accessible at all by vehicle. These are our mule ambulances. And and the health agent that walks the furthest walks 14 to 16 hours to get to Jeremy, where the only hospital is. COMBIT means communities organized for mothers and babies with innovation and technology. We were fortunate to get a child survival grant in 2004 to build on what we knew and to expand with our partners to new innovative approaches. We already had an 80% exclusive breastfeeding rate. We already had established village health workers, mothers' clubs, fathers' clubs, youth groups, more or less 6,000 volunteers that worked alongside the 180 staff of HHF. The Canadian Sisters of the Good Shepherd and the Ministry of Health were able partners. We worked together with a maternal newborn focus to expand danger sign recognition from prenatal to intrapartum, postpartum, and for the neonate. Basically, neonatal care is like nowhere on the horizon. You know, newborn assessment, newborn resuscitation, it's really nowhere, was nowhere. We worked very closely with the College of Nurse Midwives to implement Haiti's first home-based life-saving skills program that also built on the JAPIGO life-saving skills initiative for the clinics. So, but if nurses, like, you know, rotate every year, you got to keep, you know, training over and over again. Also, what's a really, excellent example of community to hospital is our maternal and newborn mortality reviews, which thanks to Dr. Frank Anderson at the University of Michigan, we now investigate every death of every woman between 15 and 49. Not only their deaths, but near misses and newborn deaths as well. When I first got there, this was the ambulance up there on the left, a woman being carried down hemorrhaging with, you know, half the village in tow on a chair. Because of this partnership with USAID and our other partners, we now have a vehicle designated for women in crisis for labor and delivery. The model of the Haitian Health Foundation is community participation, and it really is what we do best. We are one of the few organizations in Haiti that have fathers' clubs for family health, not just for family planning. And because of that, we have seen an engagement of fathers, partners, grandfathers, you know, even if there's not a dad in the home, of a male figure in the area of oral rehydration and all the other sorts of things. In addition, we have written community evacuation plans. Who takes care of the kids, who gets the stretcher, who has the money, who, you know, who does all that. And now home-based life-saving skills I'll get to in a minute. We take, you know, we work with lots of midwives, but remember, I mean, a lot of women, about 13% of women deliver themselves. So, you know, we're not even talking about midwives. You know, we got to get to women, get to them as quickly as possible. They just, you know, there's nobody around at all. Also, interestingly, in Haiti, 25% of the TBAs we work with are men. And they are very active. Many of them are traditional healers. And that's our statistics for who had our first pass at HBLSS. It's a wonderfully practical series of activities that village leaders, traditional birth attendants, mothers, fathers learn. And everyone goes through all the, they sort of rehearse an obstetrical emergency. And so we focused on the two causes of death that we see most, which are postpartum hemorrhage and babies that can't breathe. So it's been a very popular and solid series of actions. And traditional birth attendants and village leaders will say, well, now we know exactly what to do. You know, give more rehydration and make sure they urinate and, you know, do the thing and have them drink Sierra Morel all the way on the way to the ambulance or the hospital or whatever. Traditional birth attendants in Haiti do not provide prenatal care. It's just not something they do unless there's they're herbalists or voodoo priests and people go to them for other reasons. They're called by a runner at the time of delivery and they stay in the home or come back in the home. They do the food. A lot of traditional practices, some of which are helpful, some are harmful, and some are deadly. We have worked with the University of Connecticut. A medical student came and actually did very involved interviews of TBAs called matrones. And these were what they looked like, these people we interviewed, and pretty much let them talk about their lives as traditional birth attendants, about how they became a TBA, you know, what it means to them, their role responsibilities. Basically, they say that, you know, even if the people can't pay them, this is their calling. This is what they do. And they have great fealty. They're attached to it to a great degree. It is a calling. Often people are called to be a midwife in a dream. They learn by apprenticeship sometimes. Many of them are farmers. And happily have already been members of mothers' clubs, fathers' clubs, or health committees. When asked about, you know, what they learned from the home-based life-saving skills, they loved it. There's a lot of jealousy because we haven't gotten to all 316 with a 5-day training, but we're planning on doing that. And this is, you know, our grant ended in 2009, and all of this is still marching along because we don't start things that have to stop. We make a concerted effort to integrate all that we learn into long-term care. They do refer, that was a great question. You know, when we first started working with TBAs, you know, nobody wants to admit that somebody died on their shift. So, you know, you had a really, all of our meetings are done with health agents. And so there is a corroboration of what happened, you know, no blame, things like that. Also, the continuing education they get once a month with the nurses that are in charge of their reports. We give them a little bit of money, a little bit of food, give them a clean birth kit, and talk to them about what their needs are for education. Now on to the next generation. Now where are we going to go when these 60-year-old men and women die? It's a system that's replenished itself for centuries. I mean, they don't need us to tell them to be TBAs, but we're trying to move this forward to the next generation. I'll get to that at the end. I saw that you had a 21% delivery with a skilled birth attendant. We were thrilled to get up from 10% delivering in the hospital to 21%. But, you know, with reservations, the hospital's a pit. You know, it's terrible. But we want to, you know, get them with an obstetrician, and there's only one for 400,000 people. So if any of you are obstetricians want to come at Christmas time to keep women from dying, you know, you're certainly welcome, Dr. Rosales. Anyway. We do written birth plans, but we found that people thought they were just routing slips. So we're redoing our birth plans to pictorial birth plans with a written part at the bottom for the nurses in the charts. Emergency evacuation committee, 72 of them, and they are cranking. They talk about how they saved those mothers and babies, how they, you know, who took care of the kids and who got the stretcher and, you know, who went to the fields to get the dad and stuff like that. Fabulous. So what happens is the TBA realizes that they are over their head, because oftentimes a community leader now will go with the TBA to the delivery, especially at night, because, you know, what woman wants to walk in the dark? Speaking of which, we just got these headlamps donated, but only 25, and we need like 400 of them. I only have 5 minutes left. You talk too long. Anyway, the TBA calls the village health worker, and the village health workers have only had cell phones for like 2 years. So they would send a runner, you know. And then the CHW would call the dispensary, which is, you know, dispensaries work from 10 to 2, Monday through Friday, and that's it. And if the dispensary was over, we'd send the woman there to a nurse. Otherwise, we'd call our emergency ambulance at the maternal waiting home, who would go and bring the woman directly to the hospital. Most reasons for ambulance calls, prolonged labor and hemorrhage, as you would expect. We know we've had some deaths, but we've also had over 200 families that lost their mother. This is really fabulous, and might get taken up by the government as a part of its maternal newborn protocol, is inviting traditional birth attendants, voodoo priests, community members, as well as physicians, nurses, and people from the hospital and community health agents to discuss every death and what we can do for systemic changes to prevent them from occurring again. So a health agent does a death certificate, which is a government form. They do a modified reproductive age mortality survey. The nurse midwife does the screening. She goes out to interview the family, go and look at the records, talk to the midwife, does a summary, and then we have review committees every month or so. And then we do the ICD-10 codes. I'm not going to talk about this except to say you can't work at one level only. You can't work only at the community, can't work only at the hospital. It really is the continuum of care to the home, from the home to the hospital and back again, because this is a process. So we recommend that we know that TBAs play a very key role in maternal care and are extraordinarily important in their villages, that monthly support is a hit, and making health agents be with them is very important, that home-based life-saving skills, and we thank the College of Nurse Midwives for that, is a wonderful practical tool for us, and we will expand on that. We're now starting helping babies breathe with that, you know, mannequin they fill up with water and stuff. So we're doing that soon. That community members, as I mentioned, go out with TBAs, that they're very influential. And this is the key part. We see that perhaps the next generation will be the children of these TBAs as they get through high school to be trained as auxiliary nurse midwives. And so it keeps it in the family. It's acceptable, and it's positive. Thank you. Well, there's the doctor, I tell you, is there all the time. He's there like, you know, 11 months and 2 weeks. And the only time that he's not there to do those deliveries is at Christmas time. And I'm working on getting a doctor, because women have to go to Okai, which is 5 hours away, and they die on the way. It's a government hospital. It's, you know, we could have done a hospital, but our role is to support the hospital to improve its capacity. It's tough, but, you know, we had 1929 delivery beds, and now, you know, we have new delivery beds, and so that's really positive, but it's a struggle. It'll take years to, you know, improve the way that women are accepted medically as well as culturally. Well, there's only one government facility. It's a hospital. I'm a medical anthropologist, and my entire life is understanding the cultural and traditional background, the hot and cold, and all of the practices that are integral. They're not barriers as I see them, but they're important for us to understand. The budget for the government is terrible. It's fallen apart. A lot of the people died in the earthquake. It's really difficult. Gretchen?
Stay on here and take questions for maybe another 10 or 15 minutes if you want, and invite you to leave if you feel like you need to move on, okay? But I think there are a lot of questions here, I seem to see, and I'd like to continue this conversation a little bit if you don't mind. So, yes, in the back, all the way to the back.
I have a question for our standing on the Philippines.
Can you stand up, please?
Sure.
Stand up, please.
Say the last thing.
Because abortion is illegal in the Philippines.
Yeah, right.
So what sort of services would TBAs provide to women who need?
Well, it is not legal, and I was kind of shocked that some of the attendants I talked to, you know, confided in me that, you know, I didn't take names, I wasn't going to identify anyone, but that they did. In fact, one showed me how she did it, because I asked her to demonstrate. And it's basically really rough massage. It'd be like Rolfing, you know, the uterus, basically. But they do it, because it is, you know, and there are horrible cases where women do it to themselves. I mean, you know, it's a Catholic country.
Yes.
Question for any or all of you. I'm interested to know whether you evaluate whether the TBAs actually use and apply the skills that they're learning in these trainings, and what your process is for evaluating that quality of care that they provide.
By sending a community worker with them, or a local person that's also been trained to at least know what the steps are in a normal delivery and washing hands and all that, they like, they got somebody watching them now. So, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, you're basically the maternal needle care officers go with the, and observe what they're doing, and they also have a checklist of all the things that need to, you know, go over with them to make sure that the training is, you know, successful. Not just they have knowledge at the time, or, you know, the practice actually at the time of the training, but is continuing.
In our case, we have a continuing education process with traditional birth attendants, and every 3 months they get together and they go through certain processes. It's a skill-based training. So they have to repeat and do, for example, an external bimanual uterus massage. They have to do it on the site, and that's how, by observation, their skills are, their competencies being assured.
Yes, another
question. This might be first for another colleague. What is the role of men in your project in Liberia? I see that in the session of another client, there is much focus on women and babies, but the men is not visible. And I know that in most African societies, you should involve men because, first of all, they are the socially determined leaders, and second, they are the opinion leaders. And if not, actually shape them into accept the new approaches, the new mechanism that does appear.
Actually, men are very involved. I mean, some of the community health workers are actually men. And whenever there are, you know, community meetings and everything, men are always involved. You know, the focus groups that we did recently to find out, you know, what was the reasons why the community or the mothers were not going to the hospital. We interview women and we also interview men. And when we ask, you know, who makes the decision about who's going or not going to the hospital, when the women were by themselves, they say, I make that decision. I decide if I want to go to the hospital. Then you ask the men when they were by themselves, and they say, I made the decision and my wife is going to the hospital. And then we bring them together, and then they say, I made the decision along with my husband. Or the husband would say, I made the decision along with my wife. So, I mean, in this case, because it's more appropriate to have women actually helping the women, but it does, in other aspects of the project, you know, men are an integral part of the community health promotion that we do.
That's
right. Not yet, but that's something that, you know.
It's a drug of choice for abortions in Haiti. Mm-hmm.
Is it also available for prevention of
postpartum hemorrhage? We're going to start a pilot study in Honduras using Unijet with oxytocin.
I've heard you can buy isoprostol on the street in Haiti.
Yeah.
But people don't do it.
Oh, absolutely.
Area, but they don't use it for postpartum hemorrhage.
No. They don't. It's seen as an abortion drug, so that we're going to go the same way with injections.
Okay. You have a question?
Yeah, a question for Dr. Gabriel. It seems like you've had a lot of success with the community involvement in birth preparedness and you know, mobilization to the hospital. So, I remember hearing something about Nepal where they kind of appeal to men in getting involved by doing the manly things like arrange the transport and save the money and those kind of things, and they got really into it. So I'm just wondering, in your case, what were the keys to the success?
Well, Fathers Clubs have existed for a long time in HHF, since 1994, when Dr. Robin DeVine, anthropologist, did her research on mother's work and malnutrition. And what she found was a significant finding was that fathers didn't know anything about anything. So in 1994, we started Fathers Clubs for Child Health with oral rehydration and vaccines and all that sort of stuff, you know? And so it was that research that became the basis for Fathers Clubs. And of course, what do? You know, the men, you know? But they sing songs, and they make up songs, you know, for health stuff. They build, they, you know, dig the holes for the latrines. They do the, you know, the CBA, the stretcher, you know, stuff like that.
it's great. And now we have competitions between the mothers' clubs and the fathers' clubs. Mm-hmm. Who knows more about vaccines? I mean, how many men in America know the name of a vaccine and when it's due? So, you know what I'm saying? So it's by walking with the people and acknowledging their strengths and building on those resources that it becomes a level of ownership that is extraordinary in Haiti. I mean, they built roads with nothing but machetes themselves because it was a way for their wives to get out if they were having problems. The birth space in HHF is now 39 months. Why? Fathers, do you want your wives to die, to bleed to death? We show all kinds of pictures. No. Okay, so let's support them in breastfeeding. So all those kinds of things work together, and there you have it.
Question in the back?
Why are they choosing to deliver at home? Well, first of all, it's part of culture. And it depends on, I mean, the Philippines is about 17, am I correct about this? It's 7,107 islands, and it's named the Philippines as a country by virtue of Spain, doing it for administrative reasons. It's not really one country. You can't even say one island in the Philippines is one country. So that it's going to be many different reasons. In the primarily Muslim region, which is in the south, the Sulu area, I'm forgetting the name of the autonomous regions, like something autonomous region. But it was a woman is more comfortable when she's in her home, when there's privacy, when a man is not around. And also there were many women who, a lot of women I interviewed had some deliveries at home and some deliveries in the hospital or in a birthing facility. And they would choose to go back to the home, and sometimes the reason was as simple as they needed to be near their other kids. They wanted the freedom to walk around. They wanted to deliver in the position that they wanted to deliver it. That was a very important one for many women. And that's why I think the comment about the table is that she couldn't deliver in the position she wanted to deliver in. Mm-hmm. But there are many reasons, and some of them are cultural and some of them are practical. I hope that answers.
David, what we have found in these three countries is that the main reason for women to deliver at home is it's money, it's economics. It's not really a cultural issue. It's also the decision maker who is the one who's making the decision for these women to deliver where, and usually is the husband, and the husband usually makes that decision based on economics. It's like the decision where to die. It's also made on economics. So I think we need to do more research in terms of what are the main reasons for this. For women in the developing world to choose to deliver at home vis-a-vis the hospital or the clinic. And I think there are a lot of things that we need to find out in order to address those kind of issues. Because if we relied only on cultural grounds, we might not be doing the right interventions to address those issues.
Let's thank our speakers for a wonderful panel.